You are listening to BensTorah.com.
There are three areas that the Ma'arik quotes that the Din HaChukah Sakim applies to. Just starting with his tshuva, he says the concept of, number one, a chok for avodah zarah, something that's done, we were literally doing something that was done for idolatrous purposes. Number one, a chok that involves acts of pritzah, sexual promiscuity. And number three, we're doing something, a chok, where our only reason for doing it is to mimic and literally try to copy the non-Jewish world. There's no sechel yosher, there's no common sense. There's no sechel yosher involved in what you're basically doing and following them. There's no rationale in what they're being mechadish over here. So the only reason you should be doing it, if you're doing it, is because you want to show you're copying them. And therefore that halacha lamasa is your motivational spirit. Any of those three, even separately, causes chukas akim to be activated. Now, I was discussing last week at the end of this year the shaylos concerning a beis haknesses. What I mentioned is that with the Rambam in the halachic text on page 1 of Gemara Makamos talks about lo yivna at the end of halach aleph before halach beis lo yivna makamos kibinyan heichalo shel akum kidei sheyakamtzu behem rabim kamo shehem osin, that we shouldn't make shuls, the places where Jews gather together, like the temples of the Akum of the non-Jewish world, not like their heathen temples, not like a church which is looked upon as the base of Avodah Zarah. In order, people should go there to daven, to do their needs. And if you make a shul architecturally and such like a heathen temple, then you're violating the slav of the Iser Chukas Akum. And I started, in fact, towards the end of the year, we were discussing that topic itself. I mentioned very quickly that one of the concepts involved with that was the concept of us making sure that we should not use any type of instrumentation in the shul itself. That was introduced by many reformers during that time, organs and things like that. And the fact of the matter is, the Gedolim of the 1800s who had to confront them said, your reason for doing it is not what you said, because you want to halacha lamasa be medama the shuls to the Beis Hamikdash, so they had musical accompaniment. But the reason you want to do it is because, since churches have music accompaniment, you want to have the same thing taking place in the synagogue. Therefore, if a church is a base of Avodah Zarah, it's called Chukas Sa'akum. So that's the reason they asked it. When it came to another change they wanted to implement, and that was the concept of where to place the bima, we put the bima b'emes in the middle of the Beis HaKnesses, upon which usually the Kriyas HaTorah takes place, the Rav gives the Drasha, sometimes the Chazan davens from there. In churches, their basic space of activity for the preacher and all the Mesharsim is a raised platform in the front of the church itself, and the people are positioned in the front of the church, so everybody, including the tables and everything else, are facing the audience. And that's basically what, if you ever looked in a Reform synagogue, many of them do, they have the functionaries having the tables facing the audience up front. So therefore, once again, since your kavanah is to imitate a church, it comes under Chukas Avodah Zarah and is halachically prohibited. Another change they wanted to institute in a shul was to have mixed pews. And quite obviously, this itself became a major tumult, because quite obviously they wanted to eliminate the mechitza, division between men and women. Over here, there have been books upon books written collecting the shelos and tshuvas on the topic of where we learned the chiv of mechitza and separation of men and women in the shul. Especially when it came to early America, there was a tremendous assault on having mechitza shuls, etc., etc. And the fact is, there are books that have been put together, likutim, of different gedolim of that time expressing the makaros of what the problem is. The basic source of the division of men and women in a base at Knesset is based upon the fact that the shul is called the Migdash Miat. And if it's the Migdash Miat, it means it has a microcosmic form of Kedushas HaMigdash, and therefore the tefillos in a base at Knesset have to be modeled according to the decorum that was practiced in the base of Migdash. In the base of Migdash, men and women were never allowed to intermingle when any type of service was taking place in the actual Migdash itself. Very rarely were the women ever in the Ezras Kohenim and Ezras Israel. And if men and women did gather together, it was in the context of the Ezras Nashim, which was the first major chatzir that you entered when you entered in from the eastern sector of the Migdash. There were four corners of four different types of rooms in the four corners. And the Mishnayos describe in Masechta the Sukkah and other places and Midos that what they actually did, the Tikkun HaGadol they did in the Makom HaMikdash, is that when men and women wanted to have mass assemblage in the Ezras Nashim, that section, the men were below and there were balconies, women above on near the tops of the walls on all four sides of the Ezras Nashim, of that specific Azara. The only debate that exists is whether or not it was just the balconies and with women above and the men below, or did the balconies, besides serving as a physical separation of men and women, did the balconies also have some type of curtain around them so the men could not look up and see the women in that specific area? It's machlokes rishonim exactly what was the tzura of those balconies. Now, how hidden were the women from the men below? The nafka minhag ultimately ended up with a major machlokes of how you build shuls when it comes to separating men and women in divine service. I know in Europe many times, if I've ever gone on a trip, in fact, when I went on the trip with you to Alsace-Lorraine in France many years ago, where you had the shuls of the French and German Balei Teisvis. So there, almost in all the Bate Knesios, the women were in a balcony area, and the men, basically speaking, were on the ground floor below. What I always found interesting, if you remember those shuls, is that the place where the rabbi used to give a drasha was not down on the men's section on the floor, but he had an elevated platform, like a middle of the air over there. It was like a circular type of staircase that used to go up. So he was between the men's section and the women's section, like hanging.
It was in the churches too.
Yeah, it could be. But I'm saying that was very prevalent in the synagogues we saw. Even the platform upon which the Kriyas HaTorah took place, some of them were on the floor, some of them were elevated a little bit into the air. But Bangkok, by the definition, most of those shuls had women in the balcony above, women that could be seen from the floor below. There was no veil around them. And that's why, when I spoke to Rabbi Pelkas many years ago, when I became the Rebbe of the White Shul, he told me that he relied upon the balcony construction in the main shul based upon the tshuva of Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of his tshuvas, discussed the concept of separation of men and women in the shul, and, you know, called obviously the Migdash Miat, the Beis HaMikdash being a dimyon. Rav Moshe accepted the girsa that it caused a physical separation of men and women, but there was no iser for the man to look from the ground up to the woman to look to the man below. That was not prohibited. It was just intermixing them and then being on the same floor together without a separation physically between them. But once they were above and they were below, you can't have a bigger separation by that. So therefore, it was the hafrada of the men and women that was the hakpada of the Beis HaMikdash.
That's the main difference we did.
So what happened is quite obvious. That's why many of the, I would say, of the Ashkenazic world in particular, even of the Sephardic world, because we were also in Nice. And remember, we saw the synagogue of the chief rabbi, who that was in Nice at that time. Also, you were able to see the women from the balcony, but the women were above, the men were below. In the Hasidic world, by and large, they accepted the girsa of a curtain surrounding from all sides, so that women should not be able to be visualized, period, when the comes for a man standing below and looking above. And if that's what you claim happened in the Makom HaMikdash, then your Migdash Miat therefore had that mechitz as well. What's interesting over time is that because of the derech of people feeling that kol hamach maharei ze meshubach, that many of the Ashkenazic members of the world, especially the yeshivish world, accepted the minig of having the mechitz itself cover the women in the balcony. I mean, Lakewood, they went one step further. They're actually in almost a different room. If you've ever been in many of the new shuls being built in Lakewood, you have mamash surrounded by wall on all sides, and there's a two-way window, you know, between where the women's section is and the men's section when it comes to how the women are able to hear what's going on over there. But the fact of the matter is that that was another major problem that was developing. And therefore, anybody who had mixed pews, they looked upon this chukas akim, chakavay dazara, taruvis. My Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, in one of his famous tshuvas on the topic, paskin that therefore to sit in a mixed pew shul is a mais avera, it's a bittul of kedushas hamikdash miat. And he said, if you would hear a tekiya shofar in a mixed pew synagogue, he halachically classified it as a mitzvah haba ba'avera, and you would not yaitza the mitzvah tekiya shofar in that specific context. That's how far the Rav went in his tshuva on the topic itself. Rav Moshe looked upon, you know, conservative and especially reform shuls. He says they were mufa from kedushas hamikdash. He said they were nice auditoriums, you know, but you know, the kedushas hamikdash didn't have because of the mixture. So that was another heated debate. And once again, Rabbi Yisai, that was more a din in Migdash and Kedushas Beis HaKnesses than the Chukas Akir phenomenon. But some Gedolim said that since your aspiration is to make it church-like, they added Chukas Akir in as another dimension of the prohibition. One of the interesting, fascinating phenomena that I found, that I think you can find fascinating tonight, is the question of Nusach HaTfilah. This I think you'll find fascinating. When it comes to Nusach HaTfilah in a Beis HaKnesses, so we know for a fact that the Nigunim that are used by Yom HaRayim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, those parts of the year, so there you already have a lot of Shelos and Tshuvos literature discussing in the names of the early, early Gedolei Achronim, and even B'Shem HaRishonim, that there were Nuschos of Nusach HaTfilahs for the Yom HaRayim that go back Shonim, Shonim, Kadmonia, some time of antiquity. They were made with certain types of nigunim that have a certain type of reverential, you know, essence to them. That's why it's almost universal, no matter where you go in the world, and you know, Rosh Hashanah, everybody davens in a similar minig when it comes to those nigunim. And those nigunim were preserved by many of the gedolim and transferred in the Sorah. I know in YU's Cantorial Institute, they're very mocked when it comes to Nusach HaTfilah to give them over the actual nusach of the way the tamim were basically sung during the Yom HaRayim because of this mesiris when it comes to davening on Yom HaRayim. When it comes to davening the rest of the year, there, no matter where you're going, you know, it seems to be open for whatever you want to do. And what's interesting and fascinating is the following question. If there's no mesiris during the rest of the year, and the fact of the matter is there is a statement in the Sefer Chasidim that people, if they can, should put their tefillah to music, because Chazal say when you have a tefillah that's said with a musical backdrop, it causes a spiritual elevation. They bring a raya from Elisha Hanavi, that when Eliyahu Hanavi went up to Shemayim, so he was in a state of tremendous depression. He lost his Kriyach HaNavuma momentarily. And the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Lamed Beis, if you look it up, the Gemara says that during that period of time when people came to him to ask him for a nevuah, he says, I just can't, I'm so depressed. You can only have nevuah if you're sure in the concept of simcha shel mitzvah. If you look in the Rambam, Perek Zayin, Hilchos Yesod Yetorah, that he talks about nevi'im, he says, the nevi'im who didn't know whether they're going to get nevuah or not, only Moshe was able, at least when it comes to a navi, to demand nevuah on the spot. Other nevi'im, they can prepare themselves for nevuah, but there was never a guarantee they're going to get it or not get it. They used to have musical instruments playing around them continuously when they were in the mood for nevuah to get themselves mentally elevated on a certain level with simcha shel mitzvah, because the Gemara says when Elisha finally decided he wanted to get back into the prophetic mode, so the pasuk in Sefer Melachim is, he says, kechuli menagin, bring me a geshmaka, a bal menag, I'm a good singer, I'm a person. And it says, Kasher Nagin HaManagin V'Tiyo Lov Yad Hashem, all of a sudden he went into a mood swing of Simcha Shel Mitzvah, and Nevuah was able to return to him. So based upon that specific episode, Rav Yehuda Chassin Sefer Chassidim says that especially when you're davening during the whole year on Shabbos and Yom Tov, Shon Yom Kippur is a separate phenomenon, that you have to try to have nigunim accompanying your davening in order to put yourself in a state of Simcha Shel Mitzvah to elevate your tefillas in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's interesting to note, I mean, during the week we don't have too much time to put it in nigunim. Halavai you should be able to say the words, let alone the nigun alone, because we just, you know, we speed daven over here. But the fact of the matter is, by Ashkishno, by Sfardim, they do have a nigun. Otherwise, they daven, they're pretty slow compared to us Ashkenaz when it comes to even weekly davenings. But when it comes to putting a nigun, so where do we get these nigunim from? So there's a very famous tshuva written by the Chidah that is later on quoted by Avadya Yosef, where the question is posed, are we allowed to take nigunim, not lyrics, but musical notes, songs, that are used by the non-Jewish world, and take them and readapt them and put our words of Kedusha and put them and connect them together to use that as a musical script for the purpose of davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Can we borrow from the Goyim? Beautiful, beautiful scores of music, but obviously lyrics we're not going to use, but the music, and apply it to our davening for musical accompaniment. And the Chidah, he lived in the 1700s. He was one of the Sephardic geniuses, or Chaimus David's Law, he was a Makubo, you know, you just name it. He was it, he was an encyclopedist. So he writes in his Birch Yosef, and his other, he also wrote an incredible amount of tshuvas. If you saw the library of the amount of books he wrote, you know, he was like a walking library, and he wrote a library of Svara. So he says that many of the poems and the liturgy and the tefillos that he wrote, he used to take the Arabian music, because he lived in Arab countries, and obviously he deleted the Arab lyrics, and he used to use those melodies, those nigunim, as the backdrop for the tefillos that they sang in the Beis HaKnesses, that they sang when it comes to the holy convocations of the Sephardic community. And he says there's no problem of Chukas HaAkum utilizing their nigunim. But obviously, But he says that even though some of them were Arab love songs, you know, it's interesting. Even Arab love songs. So, but obviously, the lyrics he surely had to get rid of, but the music was so melodious, he said he had no problem doing that. Because the fact of the matter is music, it's an international phenomenon, it's a Mesoira person, and therefore as long as you put Shirei Kodesh with that nigim, there's no problem. The fact of the matter is, in that tshuva of Avad Yosef also was an encyclopedia, he says, even when you look in the Ashkenazic world, when it comes to tshuvos, so he quotes the Bach, not the Bach who wrote Nigunim, but the Bach who wrote the Parish on the Door. So the Bach says that the only music that they basically asked, even the Ashkenazi community, that was music that was used, classical music that was used in church services. So once music was used in a church service, it became Chukas HaAkum, and for us to then even to clean out the lyrics and use ours became a Dava Aser. But music that was not used in an official church service or a heathen temple service, we could take it from the Hamanam and therefore redo it with our nigunim. Many people tell me, I mean, I didn't live in Europe, but many of the nigunim that we use them in shuls today here are brought in from Europe. Some of them were marching songs, the marching nigunim that we use especially in the Gaish countries they came from. And since it was not used in the religious context of their churches and things like that, but it was so therefore they incorporated that as nigunim when they came to Daven Eve in the Beis HaKnesses. The fact of the matter is, what is interesting, I find fascinating, is that people today, I mean, from our generation, I hear sometimes in certain shuls nigunim used that my time was rock and roll. And then what they basically did is they rerouted it. I don't know if you realize, sometimes you go into certain shuls, certain nigunim, especially when it comes to Anzimiros or other stuff, you know, that they sing, Adon Olam, that they basically take those nigunim, you know, and basically reword them with our words. And all of a sudden, it's Gevurah and Nehelig and Negin. But what I'm pointing out is, interestingly, historically, this has been in existence for thousands of years, and therefore we shouldn't be surprised about it. But the fact of the matter is this is, in fact, a quote discussed by the Gedolei Pesach when it comes to Chukas Akum phenomenon. Now, the next thing I want to discuss, and that is, I mentioned last week the concept of a shul. There's one more piece about a shul that's very interesting. And that is the minig that Klaisa has to decorate the shul with flowers on Shavuos. Now the minig hakadmon of decorating a shul with flowers when it comes to Shavuos goes back to the time of antiquity. It's brought down in the Midrashim that the Rabbanu Shem performed a miracle in the Sinai. And that is that around where Har Sinai was, even though it's in a desert, and obviously there wasn't too much agriculture there, but around Har Sinai, it was magnificently beautiful, all types of agriculture, trees and grass and flowers. It was literally a picturesque scene around Har Sinai. So says the Midrashim, that since Kabbalah Soter was done in such a picturesque, beautiful scenery with flowers and trees and things like that, we want to recreate the aura of Kabbalah Sotera on the Yontif Shavuos. That is the source of the minig, of therefore spreading all different types of flowers and plants and trees and asovim and the Beis HaKnesses to retry to create the aura of Maimed HaSinai. The Shulchan Aruch brings this down in the halachas of Shavuos. And the fact is, if you look in our community, both in the shtiblach and in the big shuls, it's pretty popular all around to basically do that. You know, people buy fancy vases of flowers, whatever it is. But that seems to be a minig that, I would say, most of the Knessios is practiced to this very day. And since the Makar came from what happened in Maimon Har Sinai, even though Goyim might have flowers in their churches, we're not learning from them. It's a minig based upon historical phenomena of a Kabbalah Satera. So it didn't come under the normal Gedorah Mechukas Sa'akum. And the one Gadol who disagreed, and I have it written down over here, I want you to hear what they say, B'Shmei, is the Vilna Gaon when it came to the following. He says, when it comes to putting, the asavim and all types of plant things in when it comes to a shul, so that's what I mentioned up until now. In some places, they even put trees in Bati Knessios because there were trees at Har Sinai.
Sure.
The Gaon came along, and the Chacham Sadin, who was the Talmud of the Gaon, quotes, "Hagrom Mavatel Min Examineshu Chol Ka'akam." He basically was Mavatel, basically speaking, bringing trees into a synagogue in Shavuos, because he felt that since there is a Goyish holiday called Xmas, where trees is a major functional part of their celebration. So he felt for us to do it today is basically a shayla of chukas ha'akum. It might even be a chukal avodah zara, not just being mizdamo.
What?
He didn't bring that. No. So the fact of the matter is, the way that it's quoted over here, I'll just quote you what they say, the way his sheet is quoted is, and this is brought down by the Chaye Adam in Siman Kuf Lamed Aleph, Hagra bitl minig melahamid ilanas batzeres meshum shulchol ka'amim lahamid ilanas bechag shalahem. The Gaon writes this once again in the Maaser Rav, his Sefer and Halacha, accepting Xeris, and lahamid ilanas kim'ach sh'enu eliminig v'lo midina v'ach shuav chol ka'amim. It's interesting. He says, since it's only a minig, and there's not an ikad din or chiv according to Torah law for us to do such, it's just based upon a minig, and now it became a chok amim to have this done on their holiday, therefore it is appropriate to mevatel the initial minig that existed, and that was the Shitas Hagon. What is interesting to note is that the Aruch HaShulchan claims that in Europe, many, because of the protests of the Gaon, stopped doing that specific minig. Ramosha Feinstein says that he remembers many of the Lithisha, because of the Gaon's protest, also changing the minig. But Afalpikan, I think,
not to do anything.
Yeah, not to do anything. Not only not to put trees,
not to
put anything in the Bati Knessios. But it seems from our community alone, you look around, everybody does it. Everybody does this. So quite obviously, we don't put trees necessarily in the shul, but we're putting other things, flowers of kedoma. That is practice, but you should realize this became a hot issue when it comes to chukas sa'akum, and the gom b'chlau when it came to chukas sa'akum was more machmir than anybody else when it came to the halachic parameters of this specific concept. Now,
you didn't discuss Thanksgiving at all?
I'm going to get to that right now, since next week's Thanksgiving. So let me just segue there to very quickly. One of the hot issues that came up in halakha literature based upon modern custom over here was whether or not Jews should celebrate Thanksgiving. Now, one thing is for sure, celebration of quite obviously Xmas and celebration of even New Year's, since they are idolatrous in their roots, there's nothing to talk about that. When it comes to Thanksgiving, historically speaking, if you think about how it came into existence, I think the Puritans, the fact of the matter is, what was the major theme? It's basically a suit of Hakara Satov, thanking God that the colonies were succeeding and that they were replanting. People from Europe to America were successful, and they wanted to recognize all the blessings God of the universe gave them. Now, if it was the Puritans who were the major instigators, many say the Puritans were not Oved Avodah Zarah. They rejected Trinitarian Christianity, and that's one of the reasons they left Europe to come to America, because they were persecuted there and their lives were at stake. So they were more like Unitarians than Trinitarians were. We had the discussion about, you know, whether or not Christianity is Avodah Zarah. I told you there are many Peskim who held that Unitarians, or those who believe Yeshua was a Navi rather than part of the Godhead, would not therefore look upon that type of Christianity as an Avodah Zarah phenomenon. So if they're the ones who were one of the creators of this, didn't have any Christian sociological connotations when it comes to that. And therefore, so the Rav Zatzal, my Rebbe, was very emphatic. He says, Hakara Satev, according to Chazal, is perhaps, according to the Rabbeinu Bachim and Bekud and Chavis Lavavos, is the most important Yesod in the entire Torah. In fact, he quotes Rabbeinu Bachim quite interestingly. Rabbeinu Bachim says, what was the Ikechet of Adam HaRishon? Was the eating of the Eitz Adas Tevora? He says, no. The Ikechet is that when Hashem approached him and basically confronted him, what the heck did you do over here? So he says, Isha Shanasati, Hishigar Malachtai. He was Kofi B'Toiv in the Bria of the Ezek Enegdo, the wife that Rabban Hashem created him. So he says, the Ikechet of Adam HaRishon was not eating Eitz Adas Tevora, but his lack of Hakara Satov for the creation of Isha and being Kofi Tov. So he wants to claim that that is the Ikki Yisod of Kol HaTeru HaKara Satev. That's Rabbeinu Bach, Ibn Bakud, and the Slavus Lavavais. And what's interesting to note is that even the Sefer Chinuch says, why is it that the Rabban Hashem placed the Mitzvah Kibbutz of Aim in the part of the Luchos that's basically Ben Adam L'Makom? Why didn't he put it in the Ben Adam L'Chavero? So he says, besides the fact, you know, Shutfin B'Adam, that, you know, the man, father, mother, and the Rabban Hashem are Shutfin, the creation of man, so maybe that's a connection. He says the more definitive connection is the Sefer Chinuch. Sefer Chinuch says, what's the Makar of Kav Kibbutz of Aim? Hakara Satayi, for what your parents did to bring you up, the Mesiris Nefesh, the sleepless nights, and everything else. So Hakara Satayi is the Ika Hashkafa, the Sharash HaMitzvah of Kibbutz of Aim. She says, and what is the Yotzei Daifin? If you're able to perfect the Hakara Satov to your parents, what they did for you, and develop that with Kibbutz of Aim, that will then bring you to ultimate Kavod Umara HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because Hashem was Maksha. He caused a similarity between Kavod Umara to himself and Kavod Umara to your parents. The Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim says that Lashon. It's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. So if that's the case, Hakara Satov is the Iki Yisod of Kibbutz of Aim that connects it to Kavod Umara HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why they claim it was put in the same Luchos, because one basically brings to the connection of others. So therefore the Rav held that since the whole concept based upon Hakara Satayif to the Rabbanu Shalom, and I mentioned many times that even when Rav Moshe Feinstein was once asked the Shaila whether or not we should allow prayer to be introduced into public schools, so Rav Moshe had a very interesting take upon it. Rav Moshe says, if you have the person who's mechaber the tefillah to be not a cleric, but a person who's going to write a prayer that we thank God without mentioning which God you're talking about, but there's a prayer of thanking to God, he says not only is he not against that, but in a very famous tshuva he says he encourages it for one simple reason. Because since we have to be a nation that is inspiring an Erla Goyim when it comes to their spirituality, giving recognition that you have to depend on God for everything you have in this world is a major hashkafas ha-Torah. And that's why Rav Moshe says the same way Be'es HaTzara, there's a chiv d'orais for a Jew to pray to God, a guy, when he's in the Be'es HaTzara, has a chiv d'orais, al tzdini b'nei Noach, of his recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to pray to God. He says, doesn't this say when it comes to the ultimate gula, ki basi base tefillah yikara l'chol ha'amim, at the base HaMikdash, Yishai says it's going to be a base of tefillah that everybody goes to when it comes to prayer. They ain't going to go to the Vatican anymore. They ain't going to go, Rabbi Yisai, to Mecca anymore. Everybody's going to come to the Mokam HaMikdash. So if that's the case, he says, having Goyim be sensitized to the importance of prayer and dependency upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a deraisa concept we should be advocates of. So therefore, the Rav Zatzal, interesting enough, the Rav therefore was a big advocate for therefore not having any problems about celebrating Thanksgiving. In fact, the OU always had its national conventions, its weekends on Thanksgiving, and they were bedavka makbid to celebrate Thanksgiving, because the major Sudas Nitzah had turkey and all its trimmings to show, you know, adherence to the Rav's Psak. What's fascinating is the good also has it on Thanksgiving.
No turkey.
What? I don't know if they have turkey or not. But what's interesting is Rav Moshe had tzfeikus about it. That's what caused the problem. He said, I don't know. I don't know. Rav Moshe says, I'm not asking you eating turkey, but don't do it with Shem Mitzvah of the day of Thanksgiving. But the fact is, it was Rav Moshe, I think, not unwillingness to, even though he said in that other tshuva that we're to give hakaras atayv is a gevaldik kazach, and therefore praying to Hashem is a gevaldik kazach, or if for some reason, I don't know who talked to him first, he wasn't willing to. But so the fact of the matter is, by and large, the Rav felt this hakaras atayv, there's no chukas akim, there's a sechel behind it, it doesn't come under any of the three iser of chukas akim, it's not being mizdama lehem, because hakaras atayv is something that's taught in the Torah, and that's why we're doing it. So therefore, that's why, obviously, by and large, at least in the modern Jewish community, we don't go crazy about it. But I can see in the yeshivish world, based upon them taking Rav Moshe's tshuvas on this topic, which is very short and very, very indecisive, I can see them making, you know, a big deal of this. Now, the next interesting topic when it comes to this, and that is the question of Lavush. I think I mentioned last week the tshuva of Moshe about the begadim. Did I talk about clothing last week? About the fact that in America, all the shmata makers are based with Jews initially, if you think about it. So they weren't making it for idolatrous purpose, they were making it for universal usage. The only begadim that Moshe was against was big day priests for women to wear, as the chok l'shem priests mentioned by the Marik, but otherwise he didn't have any problem.
All the big fashion houses were owned by Jews.
Yeah.
And the reason was,
yeah,
because the Jews in the previous generations, they were tailors. They were permitted to be tailors. It was a fach.
Yeah.
And as soon as they, you know, we entered into the Industrial Revolution and the freedom that came with it,
yeah,
they turned from being tailors to being designers. And
you are listening to BensTorah.com.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way my Zayda lived in that Kufa, and he became a shmata manufacturer. And I heard the stories of the factories and the sewing machines.
Van Huysen. He's a peddler with Van Huysen.
So in any event, so that wasn't the problem. The interesting phenomenon, however, is the question that you find in Poskim about the chiyuv of having your head covered continuously, at least with the yarmulke. And there's a famous psak of the Taz that everybody quotes, where he says for a Jew to go around without a yarmulke is a shayla of chukas akam. So since the guy in Makbid, the bedavka, not wear their head covered, but especially when they sit down, for us to uncover a head would be a chukas akam timim is damalahem. But what's interesting is when you look in the literature on this topic, at the end of the day, even Rav Moshe and others say that Bezman HaZeh Goyim go around hatless, not because of any ideology and philosophy. I mean, there used to be a time that Goyim used to be mocked to have their heads covered with hats. I mean, I think Kennedy was the one who was buried by
outdoors, indoors.
Yeah. But the fact is that outdoors they used to wear hats, as you know, I don't know if they wore Borsellinos, but they wore the hats outside. And I think Kennedy
Stetson,
was the one.
Stetson.
I think Kennedy was the one who was the player of Ged on that.
He went to the inauguration without a hat.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is in general, Rav Moshe says that today not wearing your head covered because of Chukas Akimi says that doesn't apply to it. It might have applied in those days, but it doesn't apply today when it comes to that. The reasons for covering your head is based upon other yisaidus. And that is the first time you ever have a mention in the Gemara about the chiv of covering your head is the Gemara in Shabbos, where the Gemara tells us that a certain gadol, Ruch HaKedesh, said that he heard from Baskel that a certain woman gave birth to a certain type of young man, that the Musa Shmuz given to this woman is, this child might have certain types of keichas that are very dangerous, and to curb those keichas, keep his head continuously covered, this will give him merer shamayim, and therefore will basically prevent him from having his wild taivos, which are... So the concept of the yarmulke is Yare Malka. That's what the initial where the word came from. Yare Malka, the fear of heaven, the fear of God. That's how the terminology was used. In fact, the Gemara says in Shabbos that once something knocked his head cover off, and all of a sudden his typhus started to basically build up with him, and he was climbing a tree to gang for somebody else's fruit. So the Yiras Hashem is one of the first earliest makaros. You then find later on, like the Chassam Sofer and other Gedolim point out, that it's a concept of anivus, humility, you're basically having your head covered, etc., etc. It then some claim it's a das Yehuda, that men should have their hair covered to show certain types of Jewish dress, which became traditional over time. But at the end of the day,
you cover your hair in a shul when you make a bracha. They always did.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
When it
comes to making a bracha, it's interesting. The fascinating phenomenon is, when I looked at Gemara and Shabbos, is they never connected that to making brachas. They just connected that to humbling this person. They never made the connection. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is today, universally it's accepted, you don't make brachas with a gilei rosh. I mean, the Sfardim, it's interesting. When it comes to going to work and doing things like that, you already find heter amongst many, many, many poskim, especially in the Sfardish world, that when they go to work, quite obviously, they don't necessarily cover the hair, especially if they feel they'll have an impediment in their business activities. The Kedoymer, that was a big thing. Many from doctors, from your Tekufa,
Before me.
Were very mocked, they were concerned not to have their heads covered during their work, the fear that, he's a Jewish doctor, whatever, not, it would basically be an impediment to their parnasa. Today, bedavka from Jews in hospitals, bedavka go with their head covered, and what that reminds me of...
What? The minority, unless in my generation we're more from doctors than there are today.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but the fact is, in your generation, did most doctors who were from go with yarmulkes or not?
Yes.
They did?
In your
generation?
Yes. The generation before me, no.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But my generation, yeah, but the number of from doctors now is less than is in my generation.
How do you know that?
Because I still teach, and very few come past by me.
Where do you teach?
In New York, I know.
New York Pioneer, that's where you in your school.
Yeah.
Your school. I can tell you.
Except for Einstein, there's very few.
I'm telling you, I don't see that. I see now.
Very few.
I teach collegians. I can tell you now where collegians are heading, males and females. They're heading to medical school, they're going for PAs, they're going for doctors.
PAs, Zephyr
PAs, doctors, nursing.
I'm talking about doctors.
I'm talking about doctors also.
I'm not talking about nurses.
Lawyers almost never wore yarmulkes in my day.
Because
a lot of lawyers are walking around.
In the courts in those days, there used to be a time that they didn't want you to have even the Geisha courts, Dina Mechusadina. So that's already brought down by the post. That's Dina Mechusadina, it's not Chukas Akum. So that's a thing. In many public schools, they used to wear
toupees
in order to circumvent those specific problems. But the fact of the matter is, the poskim are over here, they have a pretty good handle upon it. And quite obviously speaking, when it comes to making brachos, I mean, it's almost universally accepted, you know, that we put, have our head covered. But the fact of the matter is when it comes to, when you're not in shul davening, you're not making brachos, the kedayim there, that the Ashkenazim and Sfardim, really, the minhag has been really split between those two groups. It's more an Ashkenazic to wear than by the Sfardim.
In Germany, I hear even the Rabbonim didn't wear yarmulkes. The Rabbonim, I think, did not wear yarmulkes.
Like during when? Some, when?
In the period of extreme anti-Semitism there.
Probably in the... It could be. I mean, I think the Rabbanu who taught in the colleges, they also who basically had colleges over there, who were professors, there surely they did not do it. But the fact of the matter is that in a Baruch Shem today, the Maram Shik, now there's another Shayla, and that is, should you have English names besides Hebrew names? So there was a big machlokes of antiquity between the Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, the Maram Shik, and the Marashdan who lived before them, whether we could, the calling yourself by a Gaiish name is a Kukas Akram Sheila. The Marashdan says that he felt that it is not. The Maram Shik went crazy about it, but Teres Chumra, that the calling yourself by a Gaiish name, even though he might have a Jewish name as well, but is a Kukas Akram Aisa. So he tells a story, the Maram Shik, that he was once, wherever he was, in a specific place, and the guy turned to him and said to him, you know something? I'm very shocked about you Jews. You claim that you're God's chosen people, you're the Am HaNivchar. And what's interesting is, he says, when I look around to other non-Jews of other different religions, they bedafka name their children with their religious names of their specific religion, like Muslims always are makbid to call their kids
Muhammad,
after them.
You know,
half of them are called Muhammad, you know, the other one.
Ibrahim.
But the fact is, they have no problem calling themselves after their Gaisha religious ancestors. And even the Christians, you know, they use a lot of biblical names, but they also call themselves after their saints, whatever it might be. And you guys, you know, you Badavka, you're the first in the country, all of a sudden to use the Gaiish names besides your Jewish names, you know, what's going on over here? So when the Ramshik heard that, he said, it's like if God sent him a message over here, like, you know, I got to protest that, and that's why he became such a machmir. But the fact is, at the end of the day, I always point out to people that one of the most interesting proofs that a Gaiish name, ironically, can be sanctified, become a Jewish name, is Alexander. You know, Alexander first came as a Jewish name because of Alexander the Great.
You find in the Gemara certain
But the fact is, Alexander the Great is the most famous proof to it, because the fact is, because of the Hanoi he gave to the Jews at that time when they had that Pekisha, as a Hakara Satov to him, they started calling the kids Alexander. Now Alexander became Kodesh Kedoshim, Alexander Rebbes, and things like that. But I'm saying, if you think what the source is, it's quite interesting. But the Marashdam himself brings your proof. Now, for the Gemara, many times you find that the Jews used Gaisha names and nobody made a big deal of it. But the fact is, what's interesting is this became also a diun, you know, defining. When it comes to the Gemara says, the Medrash says, why did Klal Yisrael have the ability to, at least on some level, not totally assimilate and acculturate the Mitzrayim? Because Yaakov and Yosef made sure that they were not Mishana Shmam, Lashonam, Umabusham. So therefore that kept them on a certain level separate from the non-Jewish, even though it wasn't totally successful, because I always point out in the Haggadah, you find the Stira, it says Hoy Mutsuyanem Sham, which means the concept of not Mishana Lashonam and their language, their dress and their names. But Chazal say they literally were involved in Mem Tashari Tuma at the same exact time. Atal Arum Ve'eriya, if we come to that Haggadah, you're totally naked from mitzvahs, you're assimilating, acculturated, despite L'meshana Shmam L'sheinim, etc. And therefore they need a Bris Mila and Karban Pesach to give them the Schus and Mesirus Nefesh for them to be Yetzif and Mitzrayim. So it's not always a guarantee, but that Medrash is used by some to show you that it's important for your definition of who you are. That's the reason that Medrash in Europe, in some communities, they were makbedafka to have a Jewish type of clothing that you button differently and look differently, etc., etc. In America, Rav Moshe didn't push that, but the fact is, in certain places in Europe, they definitely did push that because of that reason. What?
I see them.
Button. Yeah, they're still button differently. Absolutely.
I can't do it though. I'm trying.
No. Now,
it's like women.
I have my kids,
but it's like
I
women.
Button my kids,
but it's like women.
Now, what is interesting, Rabbi? What's also interesting, Rabbi Isai, is that when it comes to minhagim of avelus, in particular, when it comes to tachrichan and aronos. So over here, there's major differences between what we do with our dead and what they do with their dead. I mean, when it comes to the Geish dead, not only do they formally dress them in the coffins in tuxedos and fancy suits and clothes, but they also have cosmologists who have specialized in making them look better than perhaps they looked the rest of their life, in the open coffins and the lakes and such. And the coffins are also made from metal and this and that, whatever it is. Some have golden caskets.
That wasn't Chukas HaGoyim, that was a Takon.
So the fact over here is there's a combination. Besides the fact that, you know, and we also, when it comes to us, we're makbid to use pishtim when it comes to not anything fancy. Rav Gamliel, who was one of the Nisim, was Mezalzel B'Yatzma. Now, interesting, historically, the Jews before that Takana used to compete with each other and came to death. Who's going to spend more money on the shrouds? Who's going to spend more money on what they're going to wear? And the coffins are good nightmare. It became such a competition. The Gemara says many mishpachas used to just leave the dead mishpacha and run away because they just couldn't compete. They couldn't compete until Rav Gamliel was mazalza ba'atzmai. So Gemara at the end of Masechta Tzmei Kata. So the fact is, Rav Soloveitchik said that in actuality, what happened, especially once he did what he did. He basically says, "Altsminig of Avelus, especially when it comes to these things, for you to have fancy, expensive coffins and fancy, expensive clothing, kedomas, they're going to. At that point already, is a chukas akim phenomenon. It transferred it into a chukas akim phenomenon, and therefore he was always telling people that you know to have the most expensive, simple wood coffins because you can have a wood coffin, but you can have one level, you can have a different level." So he says, the coffin was never meant to be furniture that you're burying in the ground. He says, "Those is a shell about tashkas. What are you going to do? Just going to take a fancy wooden coffin and bury it in the ground? I mean, it doesn't make sense." So the fact of the matter is that some said the difference in minhagim ultimately turned out to be a chukas akim phenomenon as well. The next thing I want to mention is Karev Lamalchus, which we discussed a little bit last week, that there were gedolei tanoim. Who the Gemara tells us used to be involved in the Roman courts, in the Roman forums, who the Gemara tells us used to wear Roman robes and cut the hair like the Romans did to participate in their forums. They were called in Halacha Karev Lamalchus, and in the first page of the Makaris that you have in front of you, the Rambam writes very explicitly in Halacha Gimel, Yisrael shoy karv lamachis etzarch leishel v'nei malkehem hoyelo genai lefi shelo yidam alehem. I raise the mutal libosh b'mal shem v'yigalach k'neg gapano k'derek shem osim. The isa wearing gayisha clothing and cutting your hair like them doesn't apply to karv lamalchus because without dressing that way and cutting the hair that way, they will not be accepted in those circles. They won't be able to function on behalf of Klal Yisrael to be the melech yesh on behalf of the Jewish people, and in many countries. That was critical in order for the Jews to be safe from anti-Semitic doctrines. And in Rome, it was a mission critical, at least when they still listened to us, to have people who can advocate in the Roman forums. But the question is, if there's an Issa Daraisa of wearing the begadim and cutting the hair in the crazy ways that they did it, so what was the het of Karev Lamachus? So what's interesting and fascinating is there's a machlokes between the Beis Yosef and the Bach when it comes to that. The Beis Yosef says, the reason of the head of Karev Lamachus to dress the way, even though it's Issa Deraisa Chukas Akum, is because of Pekuach Nefesh. That's his shita. He calls this Pekuach Nefesh. Pekuach Nefesh is Daicha, everything except three Averus Chamuras. What is interesting is that the Bach says something differently. The Bach says is that sometimes we find that Deraisa mitzvahs, Isurim and Aseis Belos Aseis, were not spelled out explicitly by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Avraham Mazel Chachamim to define the parameters of this mitzvah. One of the most famous is the concept of Isa Malach and Chol HaMoed. The Gemara Chagiga says that Hashem says he asked Malach and Chol HaMoed, but Hashem really never defined it in the Torah Shabbat Sav, or even the Torah Shabbat Peh explicitly. He allowed Chazal to define the parameters of this mitzvah deraisa. You can define the parameters, what's permissible, what's impermissible. I'm just being megala that some malach should be asa chol hamoed, but you choose how to define it. And there's an interesting run in the beginning of Hilchos Yom Kippur says, that's when it comes to the chamisha inuyim that you have on Yom Kippur that exist. He says, even though they're deraisos, But except for the eating and drinking, the other ones were left up to Chazal, Moschal Mechamim, for them to define what other inuyim should take place as a kim of the deraisa of the mitzvahs inuy. So they also define the deraisa given to Chachamim. So the Bach says when it came to this, when it comes to Karol Malchus, because of the importance of it, Moschal Hakazacham, for them to define the deraisa parameters, who is bound by the Issa Chukosak when it comes to Begodim and Hirgot, and who's not bound, they felt that the Karva Malchus should be exempted from the whole Iser initially because of his functionality. So you have another example of Masa Kasav Lechachamim. Now, the next thing I want to mention. When it comes to the question of a person's Derech HaDibur, now using the slang language of the country in which you live, and some of the slang language ain't the most beautiful Lashonos, some of them are very, very bad curse words and other stuff, and some people only talk those words, every other word. So there is one Gadol from France, the author of the Sefer Samag, Sefer Mitzvahs Kedvelais, who was a French Baal HaTaisvis, who claims that even Derech HaDibur, for us to speak in slang language, using words that are basically words that are used by people who usually talk gutter type of language, besides the fact that it's not that you're supposed to talk as a Jew in the Teferes Halosha, and Chazal used the term Dibur Benachas Mabrios. That's what if you want to make Kadoshem Shemayim, the Gemara says in Yoma, you have to have Dibur Benachas Mabrios. He says that besides that positive takeaway, the way you're supposed to talk, to use the negative slang language used in a country would be a violation of Chukas Akum, because it's a Lashem Aguna Kedemer, and if that's the case, if you're doing it because you're trying to ape and mimic the Gayish of Eld, a lot of the words also might come under Lashem Pritzus or Kedemer, because some of the terms that are used in licentious ways as well. So therefore, he was one of the few Rishonim who recorded that even the way you speak comes under this specific prohibition as well. So I think just looking through the categories that I have over here, I think we have covered most of the areas of the Issa of Chukas Akum. I will tell you that Sigufi Haguf, physically punishing yourself in spiritual rectification, was some posting with the Shayla of Chukas Akum, with the Gayim, very much into self-affliction of punishment for the purposes of kapara. In fact, the Yashka, his whole drasha was, ich bin a kapara with my being crucified for your avera. So you know, that became
a very Jewish concept that we have it today.
Yeah.
Kohen Gadol, when he died, he was also
kapara. We see him today, his whole daf over
here. The daf
yomi. Nebuch Ezgavon a kapara for everybody. But the fact of the matter is, that's why it's interesting, amongst the Rishonim, the only ones who practice physical Sigufi Agur as Kapara were the Germans. The German Gedolim of the Talmud Yehuda Chassid, those Gedolim used to sleep on beds of nails, do strange things as Kapara, but most of the Jewry looked upon this as Chukas Akamaisa and didn't really accept it. Also, anything else I want to mention over here? I think I covered almost everything. Even Thanksgiving we covered. There was some shalos of whether or not a bas mitzvah celebration is a shalos chukas akum because of the concept of confirmation.
Confirmation.
So there was a big tumult about this initially when they started making bas mitzvah celebrations official. And Rav Moshe has a whole tshuva upon it. But as Rav Moshe points out, we're misinterpreting what a bar mitzvah and bas mitzvah is. I mean, it's not like the Geisha confirmation
it's
over there.
It's not confirmation.
It's not confirmation, period.
Because you're born Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is, when people say, I'll end with this, when people say, I'm 90 years old and I finally had my bar mitzvah celebration, the fact of the matter is, there's no such thing as having a bar mitzvah celebration. The concept of having parties when you were a bar mitzvah boy or even a bar mitzvah girl is very late in halach literature. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really start to really take place, and it's not even mentioned by Gedolim until like the Mashal, until the 1500s, that they started making parties to celebrate. And they call it a Sudas mitzvah. Why? The purpose of the Sudas mitzvah, the bar mitzvah celebration, the labor of the bas mitzvah, is to modiyah to the rabbim, I'm now a gadol. And now I can be used as a gadol in different type of halach areas. So it was like Pirsam Hamilsa had nothing to do with basically making them chayiv mitzvahs. They were chayiv mitzvahs. Once you're 13 in a year, and a girl is 12 in a year, you're chayiv mitzvahs whether you have a bar mitzvah celebration or not. So Rav Moshe said, because they start prostrating in their bati kinesios, in their churches. So it means we should stop bowing in our shuls on Yom Ra'im. We should stop bowing in the Beis Hamikdash. We didn't learn it from them. We didn't derive it from them. So if that's the case, one has nothing to do with the other. And if historically, Rabbi Sai, even Beis Yaakov now have celebrations of Bas Mitzvahs as part and parcel of their normal phenomenon, because you want the boys and girls to feel there's a chashivus.
You have been listening to a presentation of BensTorah.com.